You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, December 9th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Lydia DePillis, writer with ProPublica on how Trump's political employees will end up in Joe Biden's administration. Meanwhile, U.S. now breaking COVID infections daily. Near 2,600 people died yesterday. And it's going to get worse. Trump administration underbought vaccinations, and U.S. is likely to face shortages. White House weighs in on a stimulus, offers to cut enhanced unemployment for a one-time Trump buck. Meanwhile, the House passes veto-proof $740 billion for defense. Now on to the Senate. The Supreme Court rejects Pennsylvania vote challenge, but the Republican election deniers carry on. Joe Biden picks Marsha Fudge for HUD despite her agriculture background. Does so probably to make way for a dairy lobbyist. Democratic Richie Neal blocking legislation to protect us from surprise medical billing. More revelations of possible insidery trading by Kelly Loeffler. And the Senate looking to thwart a massive arms sales to the UAE. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thank you for joining us. Pleasure to have you. And with me, as is the norm, Emma Viglin. Emma, how are you today?
I am well, Sam. It seems like it's about to start snowing here in New York. So
yes. In fact, I think flurries have already begun. This is coming after the warmest November in the history of the world. And
despite
year,
weather patterns usually suggesting that this year, due to currents and El Nino or something like that, I don't really understand it, but it was supposed to be cooler, but yet it's even warmer.
Yeah, this
records all over the place.
Yes, this this year could still very well be end up being the warmest on record. I mean, that is one of the things that sort of just looms in the background is that every day the clock ticks even more. And we, of course, have had absolutely no progress, at least in terms of our government's willingness to engage in fighting climate change. Obviously, if anything, it's gone backwards. We may have lower emissions because of some slowdown in economic activity. But beyond that, nothing. And one of the things, and we'll get to this later in the program, Marsha Fudge was tapped by Joe Biden to take over HUD. And she had said, I guess, I don't know, weeks ago, that she was she had registered her frustration that HUD was basically the, you know, the consolation prize that they would give to provide diversity in an administration. And then there you have it. She sits on the Agriculture Committee, and the folks were hoping that not only would the Ag Committee, would the USDA, head of the USDA, or the, I guess, the agriculture secretary, would be a position that would deal with ag policy, but would also emphasize the nutritional aspects of it, SNAP, food security for people and climate change. And it appears that Joe Biden is going to go with Tom Vilsack, who had that position under the Obama administration. As far as I can tell from a agricultural perspective, farmers were not terribly happy with his time there. And of course, he's just coming out of, like, I think it is a 5 or 6, maybe 8 year stint as a lobbyist for the dairy industry. So there is some consternation about that pick amongst Democrats. And
although Fudge's appointment actually leaves an open congressional seat there in Ohio, and people are speculating that Nina Turner of the Bernie Sanders orbit and of the campaign could run for that seat, which would be very consequential.
Yes. And it still would have been open if she had been put in the agriculture position.
True. I'm just maybe I'm
you're looking for some silver lining.
I'm looking for some silver lining as it's silver outside, about to snow. I love the first snow. It's got me in a good mood.
Well, I hope I will not bring you down more with this, as we have a situation in the Senate, essentially, where we, for some reason, this country cannot seem to respond to the economic devastation that it is facing at the end of this month in terms of unemployment, or I should say the economic devastation of its citizens. When 12 million people are going to be thrown off of unemployment insurance, where we have millions who are going to be unprotected in terms of eviction moratoriums. A month later, we're going to have the end of the moratorium on student loans, student loan debt, I should say. And we still have Mitch McConnell insisting upon full immunity for corporations and for institutions for subjecting their workers or their customers or their members to unnecessary risks during this time by cutting corners on safety measures in an era of COVID. Meanwhile, the House, and I imagine the Senate is going to follow suit. We just don't know if it'll be veto-proof in the Senate. The House overwhelmingly passes a $740 billion defense bill, like, it, you know, a walk in the park.
Like it was nothing. And Trump's threatening to veto it because it doesn't get rid of Section 230, which is his new pet project.
And there's other, you know, I mean, Section 230 aside, because that, you know, there it's a controversial provision. But this is 335-78. You cannot veto that out of the House. We'll see what happens in the Senate. But this is here is Bernie Sanders, who is also agitating for, and the White House came in with a proposal the other last night to provide a one-time Trump bucks. I think it was $1,200 for a couple, or $600 per person, or maybe
$600 per person, $600 for a child,
and $600 for a child. And not sure what the, I don't know if we know specifically what the cutoff would be in terms of income, but that would be a one-time payment as opposed to 3 or 4 months of, and they basically got rid of 3 or 4 months of expanded unemployment insurance, and also unemployment insurance that covers people who are independent contractors. And Bernie Sanders and some other members of the Democratic Senate, I think also they're joined by Josh Hawley, have said they want a $1,200 payment on top of the unemployment expanded unemployment benefits. And
it initially appeared like the Trump administration was responding positively and joining Hawley and Sanders in this more progressive fight for a payment to Americans, even though it was half of what was initially received. But then they go, of course, actually, that means we'll push that forward, but you're not getting any federal money for unemployment insurance.
Right. And I mean, I think they have 40 billion in there, but it's not nearly enough. I mean, I think not, it's enough. Very anemic. Yeah. And I think from Trump's perspective, it's like, he's still thinking about whatever it is he's going to do after president. And he is, I'm happy to have, I mean, you can almost smell the thinking here, right? It's, yeah. I'm happy to have people have a check with my name on it, A, which won't happen if it's unemployment insurance, and B, like, I don't care about the losers. I don't care about it. They lost their job. They lost your job. But here's right. Bernie Sanders on MSNBC making the point that it is stunning that we have the ability to pass a $740 billion military budget without batting an eye, but actually providing economic relief to people in the middle of a pandemic is even remotely controversial.
You know, Stephanie, I always get a kick. Here in Washington, when we go to war, there's endless amounts of money. Tax breaks for billionaires, endless amounts of money. Corporate welfare, endless amounts of money. When children are going hungry in America today, suddenly we don't have enough money. That's crap. That's wrong. And if we have got to stay here throughout Christmas, which is the last thing in the world that I would want to do, we are going to stay here because we are going to make sure that struggling working families in this country get the help they desperately need.
That's crap.
I was going
to
say.
Got to add that to the soundboard.
It is. We do need to pull that. Pull that for me, Matt. I want to use that crap. But it is. I mean, you know, sometimes we get involved in this and it is about the fights that are happening. And we sort of accept the premise that the Republicans are, you know, they're simply fundamentally against the idea of helping people. But this basic premise, which has been true for decades, regardless of who is in power, the ability for our government and our society to get behind spending enormous amounts of money to either kill people or to grab resources or to just maintain the instrument to do that, ultimately, to maintain the threat that we can do that, versus our ability to provide for people in need, is just, it's stunning.
Well, it's upheld by this cult of individualism that's so ingrained in our culture, and then it's just justified by the institutions that we put in place there, right? So, I mean, College for All, for example, that was the same cost as the military budget increase in just one division that Trump was proposing just 2 years ago. It's very cheap based on what our government spends on a yearly basis. And this is a prime example of it. McConnell is pushing for austerity. All he cares about is the liability shield, the protections for corporations, the protections for employers. He doesn't even want to do any extension of unemployment insurance if it was his way, or he doesn't want any stimulus. I mean, that's not even in the compromise bill that Pelosi is pushing now. So we have all of these moving parts. Without Trump's ego involved, and when it's Biden as president, if we have a Republican majority still, I think it's going to be very hard to get those checks. But if the Georgian Senate runoffs go the Democrats' way, and then it's a 50-50 split with Harris as the tiebreaker, okay, potentially we could be getting those stimulus checks. There's so many moving parts, but there is one thing in Democrats' favor right now, between now and Inauguration Day, is Trump's desire to have another round of checks go out with Donald J. Trump in massive bold lettering in his signature on the bottom.
Yes. I mean, right now, if I was in the Senate, I would be floating the idea of putting his picture on these checks.
Yes. Send them out in just coins, tokens with his with his weird face on it.
You want to call him Trump bucks? Let's call him Trump bucks.
Do it.
It would be shameless, but I actually think it would be effective. I would like to see Senator Sanders get on the floor of the Senate and say, I propose that we call these Trump bucks, and we propose and propose that we call the extension of unemployment benefits, you know, Trump benefits.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it is.
Pelosi and Schumer's heads would explode because there seems to be some evidence that the checks with his name on it did have some political
effect. If he wants to run in 2024, let's deal with it then. But yeah. It really does put in stark relief how crucial this election in Georgia is. And I don't want people to mistake what I'm saying here. Georgia, those two, the election of those two members of the Senate in Georgia will mean an ability of Joe Biden to appoint judges. It'll mean an ability for Joe Biden to get his cabinet in place in a timely fashion. And most importantly, and I don't think it goes beyond this very much at all, because you're going to have Joe Manchin and Kelly and a bunch of them standing in the way of any type of like real progressive legislation. But what it will do is it will allow at least a one-time bite at an apple via reconciliation on a massive stimulus bill. Stimulus, relief, whatever you want to call it, infrastructure, any type of government spending can be rolled into that reconciliation bill, and it can be a total one-off. And then see you again next year if the Democrats are so inclined. But Georgia is hugely important, and it's frustrating because there's only so much we can do. And I think, you know, those Georgian Senate races, they want to keep it localized to a certain extent. Although I imagine that they accept your support in any way you can. But we shall see. Meantime, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Lydia DePillis from ProPublica on the her piece on how Trump's political employees will end up in Joe Biden's administration. Before we do, just want to give you a heads up on this. This has been really great, particularly, I mean, I imagine this would be just as good, but the things like this get heightened during this era, without a doubt. Literati Kids has a book club for children's ages 0 to 12. Each club has an age appropriate selections of books that are tailored to what your child needs. And what's awesome about this, they send you a box of books. I don't know, like 4 or 5. I think we got 6 maybe. And first of all, kids love getting packages, which is one thing, particularly when they're addressed to them. And it, you know, I've been through this with my first kid. Kids like different books. I mean, I get a list, from some parents of like books that the kids have to read. But then once you blow through that, you don't know what to get them. And the thing I like about this is that I can open up the box for Saul. I can show it to him and I can say, which one of these do you like? And then I always basically tell him, like, you get to pick 3 and I get to pick 1. I mean, if there's more that he likes, I'll do that. But it's always like I end up seeing a book that he doesn't necessarily into. And I that's the way I get it for him. And it's they are obviously experts at curating these books. You can get a gift subscription for 1, 3, 6, or 12 months of books. And inside the box also comes like, stickers and,
fun.
What is it? Artwork, but stuff to draw in. I don't even know what that means.
Stencils?
Not stencils, but like crayons. It's stuff to draw, like craft work and stuff.
Okay, fun.
But, he loves it. And kids, I don't know why kids love stickers so much, but they do. It really has been great. And we found some books that he really likes, and there's nothing more gratifying than seeing your kid read and enjoy it. It is, you know, I'm always on the edge with that, but my kids will dip in occasionally, they'll start reading, and it's like, literally, you want to weep. Go to literati.com. This is also a great gift for if you've got nieces or nephews, I guess, or grandkids. But it's a great gift for your own kids, which is, sort of one of those things that also ends up being a gift for yourself in some way. Go to literati.com/majority for 25% off your first 2 orders. Pick your kids' book club gift today. Remember, no one else has kids' book clubs like these. Only at literati.com. That's literati.com/majority. You get 25% off your first 2 orders and receive 5 incredible kids books curated by experts delivered to your door every month. That's literati.com/majority. You can make your little one's holiday season unforgettable this year. Oh, and also one of the things that we do on Hanukkah, which starts Thursday night, tomorrow night, is I tell the kids one night at least, you will not get presents. Instead, we're going to donate your money to a charity. And the way that I'm doing it this year to give them like an opportunity to look, I mean, Myla has some ideas, but she said she wants to do like 3 or 4 nights. But I'm not bragging about my kids.
Yeah. Well, she sounds like a good kid.
Well, she sells all her clothes and gets plenty of money, so she doesn't care. Oh, okay. All the clothes, well, I buy her. But the point is, this is a great, GiveWell has been, is perfect for this because, I plan to sit the kids down, and use GiveWell.org as, the way that they can look for charities. And GiveWell.org has been helping donors find charities for over 10 years, and they focus on projects that save and improve lives the most per dollar. Here's how they do it. GiveWell dedicates over 20,000 hours to researching charitable organizations, handpicks a few of the highest impact charities that are evidence-based their impact. All the research is publicly available. They give it away for free on their website. Since 2010, GiveWell has helped over 50,000 donors direct over $500 million to the most effective charities. GiveWell never takes any fees. All of your tax-deductible donations are given to the charity that you choose. For me, that's how I found GiveDirectly. And again, all of these charities on there, you go, you make your own assessment. But for me, I found GiveDirectly through GiveWell. I don't think they're related. I'm not sure about that, but I think it's a coincidence. But it's basically where they target where people who need direct cash assistance. It has been, there's a lot of data that shows the best way to help people who are hurting for cash is to give them cash. And they figure out how to distribute that. So extreme poverty, folks, you know, we're suffering from COVID-19 in this country. And then they have, you can target it to other places around the world where you just give the cash directly. But you can go there to givewell.org, find the charity that's right for you. You only have a few days left to make a tax deductible donation for the new year. Go right now. And when you make your first donation to GiveWell, your gift will be matched up to $250. Go to givewell.org/majority. Pick podcast and majority report at checkout. This matching offer is good for as long as funds last. Get your first donation matched up to $250 at givewell.org/majority and select podcast and majority report at checkout. Also, just a reminder, you can check out the AM Quickie. We're doing that every morning. Basically, get it out the door by 8 a.m. Top headlines, stories you may miss, stories that we don't get to even cover on this show, all within 7 minutes. If you have not tried out the AM Quickie, try it out. You can go to amquickie.com to sign up, or you can just find it on your podcast servers. Or I think we have it on YouTube at Majority Report Audio as well. But find it in your podcast feed. Okay, let's welcome to the program Lydia DePillis, a reporter with ProPublica, who has written a piece on how dozens of Trump's political appointees will stay in government after Biden takes over. Lydia, are you there?
Hi, I'm
Hi.
Here.
Well, welcome to the program, Lydia. I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
So, Lydia, the we should start off by saying that this practice of borrowing, as it's known, this happens at the end of every administration to some degree or another, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's sort of a natural thing, right? You get brought into an administration as a political appointee, which just means that you serve at the pleasure of the president. And then you maybe want to take a job that isn't one of those political appointments because you want to stick around. And it's not necessarily nefarious. And it does happen at the end of it, at every administration. And the reason it has a sort of formal term is because over the years, the Office of Personnel Management has decided to apply various processes to make sure that these jobs are not being handed out with a lot of political preference at play, because these are folks who have demonstrated that they are friends with the administration. They are chosen for that reason. So there's only the potential for political influence, but plenty of them are benign.
Well, now, what do you mean by political? What do you mean by that? Political preference?
So there's like 4,000 people at the outset of an administration who are political appointees. Only about 1,000 of them are actually Senate confirmed. So many of these people are in important managerial positions, but they don't rise to any kind of public radar. And, you know, historically, centuries ago, there was all these jobs were handed out through the patronage system. And, right. And to some extent, that still happens, right? Like, and it happened in the Obama administration. People who were field workers, like campaign staff, all of a sudden it's like, let's find you a place because reward for good service. And that's totally allowed. The thing that is more problematic is when those jobs, those people then are converted into jobs that are part of the career civil service, which come with a great deal of protections because these people are supposed to be non-political. They serve from administration to administration. And it's actually sort of difficult to fire them.
And do we know, I mean, can you tell us what the numbers are? Like, I know we have 2 million people who work in the federal government, more or less, on some level. But that includes, like, postal workers and, I mean, everybody. And I imagine this group of people that we're talking about, they come in as political appointees. There's 4,000 of them. Ostensibly, they're supposed to leave, but then some stay on because they want a career job. Or at least for a period of time, they want that career job. And so, I mean, how many, like, is there a number in there of like that type of position where they would go into an agency, get the civil service job? Do we have a sense of like how many like possible positions there are like that?
Oh, I mean, it's potentially very large, right? Like the civil service is tens and thousands of people. And so the actual number of requests that OPM gets from the administration to put its political appointees into these jobs is pretty small. So they started requiring in 2010, like all of those positions had to be reviewed. So there is a list of people, who are making these transitions, and it's submitted to Congress, and it's usually not made public. The GAO, the Government Accountability Office, does take a look at these every term or so, or whenever a president leaves office. The last time they did this, which was in 2016, they found that was like there was something like 99 requests to transition people over that entire period, 2010 to 2016, to get people who are political appointees in the Obama administration into civil service jobs. And so there was like 100 of them, and they rejected a bunch of them. And some of them and didn't end up taking the job. So the point is that it's actually a fairly small pool of people who try to make this transition. Right.
What is that figure relative to the Trump administration? There's 100 between those 6 years. Where are we now in the Trump administration? We still have another, you know, 3 or 4 weeks. And so this could keep going on. But where are we at this point?
Truly. So from what I've understood, I have the number for 2019. It's like about 33. I have the lists for the first three quarters of this year. That's another approximately 33, like with a few sort of on the edges of people who were declined the positions or were denied the positions. And so, you know, that adds up to like somewhere in the range of like 60, 70 for last year and this year. And that might be, you know, it sounds like, oh, well, that's only 2 years compared to 6 years. So maybe there's a gazillion more. That's probably not the case. I think probably more of them end up coming through later in the term. It does take a while for these people to be approved. So we won't know the total number probably until like early next year when the GAO reports. But anyway, the point is that it's not far out of line.
Okay. I mean, it's six years versus 4 years, but I guess, you know, if we get up to about 100, it's going to be, I mean, I guess more or less in that respect. And of course, if you're not leaving the administration, there's less of an urgency, I guess, to get you in there. Right. I mean, so those first 2 years of that 6 years that are, well, all right. So let me ask you this. And here's, I guess, the thing that it becomes, you know, sort of You've mentioned there are 4,000 of these political appointments that the Biden administration has to fill. Mm-hmm. And then ostensibly there's work to be done. So the resources that can be dedicated to observing who these people are, mm-hmm. and making sure they're not they're not carrying out an agenda that is more aligned with Donald Trump and the Republicans than the Biden administration is a difficult task. I mean, it sounds like it wouldn't, but it's like we've got to dedicate resources to actually doing stuff rather than sort of this rear guard effort and making sure that these people aren't sort of destroying the furniture, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because like this is a very small window into the types of, into the sort of potential destroying the furniture that could happen in this lame duck period. And it happens to be that it is carefully tracked by OPM. Like, I'm actually not sure it's the biggest way or channel through which that will happen. You know, I don't think I don't have evidence of any conscious plan that the Trump administration is trying to insert its operatives all over the government. I don't think that this is very directed, honestly. I think it's a lot of probably ideological folks with pretty partisan credentials who wish to continue their government service. And that will probably mean that wherever they are, they'll be able to like slow down regulations. If they're in the judicial branch, right? I don't want to say skew, but like push judges in the direction of more conservative rulings. And so that's certainly at play. I just think that there's at the same time a whole rulemaking process that is moving very quickly that will also be very difficult for the Biden folks to roll back or stop. So I don't want to leave folks with the impression that this is the only way in which Trump administration influence could remain to bedevil the Biden folks.
All right. Well, I want to talk about other channels in the rulemaking mm-hmm. in a second. We'll touch on that. But the big concern, and I have no doubt. Well, let me put it this way: it's not hard for me to imagine that this is not directed by some type of, you know, significant plan based upon just what we've observed of the Trump administration, even when they're doing what I would consider horribly nefarious things. They very often botch it how many Supreme Court cases have we had where the court has just been like, had you come to us and done actually handed in your homework in the proper way, we would have ruled in your favor, but we're not going to now. You can come back and provide us a better answer. But there has been a stated agenda by this administration. Steve Bannon announced it very early, the destruction of the administrative state. When Barack Obama has political appointees who go into these positions, presumably, although I would imagine there's some exceptions to this rule, they're doing it because they want to strengthen these agencies that they're getting placed in. They believe in the mission of these agencies. To what extent, I mean, and we can go over some of the individuals that you flagged in your piece that might sort of like bring some of this out, but, it seems to me like these are people who are going in and building a bank of, maybe they're doing it for ideological reasons, maybe they're doing it for career reasons that are outside of the civil service even, but going in, building a bank of favors for the corporations that these agencies are established to regulate, right? I mean, like there is a specific reason why these agencies exist, and it is to curb what the private individuals or players are doing.
Yeah. So a couple things that I would say in response to that. One, an advocate mentioned this to me, and it didn't end up in peace, but there was actually quite a few more people who ended up brewing after the Bush administration. And the theory for that, and I don't have any proof, but I think this makes sense, is that the Bush folks actually believed in the mission or the utility of government, even if they had different values for what exactly than like the Obama administration from the approach that government agencies should take, but they believe in the power of government to like accomplish their goals. And the difference with the Trump folks is that there's a ton of turnover. So it's not like, and there's a lot of people who are like cycling in and out, and a lot of these positions that were just left empty, right? Of the 4,000, I'm not sure all of them were ever even filled. And it's because the reasons you usually heard from agency heads is, well, we don't really need to do that job. So like, why would we make those appointments? Why would we fill those positions? And so the hypothesis is there may be fewer Trump administration folks going into the civil service because there's just less belief in government as having the power to accomplish whatever agenda that they have. And the other point I would make is that sure, Republican administrations, especially this one, tend to be pretty corporate friendly, although there's like caveats to that, right? Like the corporate lobby has been very mad at the Trump administration for any number of actions on like immigration and trade, et cetera. But that like the revolving door is just such a much bigger issue. Like that happens with Democrats and Republicans, and the incentives to go out into a lobbying shop or to do favors on behalf of your boss, like who in the Senate or the House. I mean, those are just really, really powerful. And like, this is a very small piece of that.
Right. So that's just quickly my question, right? So in your piece, you talk about how a lot of these borough appointments were lobbyists in the past. Mm-hmm. Is that different substantively than past appointments in the Obama and Bush administrations, like what you're talking about?
I mean, if your definition of lobbyists includes folks who advocate for labor unions, environmental groups, consumer groups, which I do, right? I don't think like all lobbyists are bad. I think they're just advocates for whatever interest that is paying them. So absolutely, Obama hired from the ranks of those folks and probably gave them civil service jobs later, right? I mean, it's not something I think it's sort of unreasonable to expect people who go into government to have a completely technocratic background. Like lots of people work for different interests. I think it's the really problematic thing is when people pull strings and engage in an uncompetitive process. So folks who don't have that kind of pedigree and those kinds of connections, but who are more qualified can't get the job. And like one person I would highlight who I did lead the story with is a young man by the name of Christopher Prandoni, who's in his early 30s. And, you know, he worked for his first job out of college was working for Americans for Tax Reform, Grover Norquist's group, which is like quite ideological. He is head of their energy shop there, and their primary goal is preventing regulations, especially around, you know, early at that time, one of the big debates was around whether to do a carbon tax. And so, you know, he made his way through the Council on Environmental Quality and then to the Department of the Interior, where he's an advisor to the secretary, and now has a civil servant appointment as an administrative law judge, deciding a lot of the land use disputes within the Bureau of Land Management. And that's a job that he could stay in forever, however long, like until the Biden administration gets around to relocating him or something. But that is a position that one of thousands in the federal government that has real, real consequences for, you know, how public lands are used.
I want to get to just go a little deeper into Prandoni and also how the Biden administration could, if they get around to it after dealing with the 4,000 that they've got to hire and you know, the pandemic, which is probably, you know, and the potential for the recession. It's funny though, the idea that they did not fill those 4,000. Do we have any sense of that the Trump administration of how many of those positions actually did get filled? Because I can't help but remember a story early on in the transition when the Trump administration came in, Jared Kushner apparently walked into the White House, one part of the White House, and was looking around and going like, okay, so who stays? and who goes? And whoever was giving him the tour said, everybody goes. These are all political appointees.
It's one of those wonderful anecdotes about how little this administration understood about government when they came in. And I don't have that number. The Partnership for Public Service may have tracked it. It's one of those things that is very irritatingly not tracked. Like, there's no central repository of appointments made to those positions that I'm aware of. I think
that's sort of amazing, isn't it?
It is, right?
Like, because we don't have a sense of like the competence, even the never mind the actual impact of what they're doing. We don't have the competence to even know like how competent they are just from an administrative standpoint.
Yeah. I mean, so there's like something called the Plum Book, which is this like large government GPO publication that lists every appointment that's political. There is, and many of the departments have their own lists of politicals at certain points in time that have come out through Freedom of Information Act requests. But it's sort of, it's like the different pieces of the elephant that you're trying to like look at to get a sense of how many jobs were filled. Because all of the early trackers on this really only did the ones that are Senate confirmed.
Right.
And there's much, it just goes much deeper than that.
So this, I'm sorry. So I wanted to jump to this, Prandone. He is now, been appointed to be a judge, from his experience. I guess he's 3 years out of law school. His experience was working in Grover Norquist's shop, as it were, which was all just about here's your portfolio, and you want to just put out a couple of position papers on why we shouldn't have regulation, essentially. Stop me if I'm mischaracterizing it. He gets appointed to the Associate Director for Natural Resources on the Council on Environmental Quality. I'm just going to guess that he said the environment's quality is fine. In fact, we're overreaching. We're making it too good in some respects, or we have more of a margin of error than one would imagine. That's just a guess, but I imagine that's what he was doing. And so now he is a judge. What does he do as a judge in that? Like, I mean, give us a sense of like what the implications are of this Grover Norquist acolyte, his sitting in that position. How big are the cases that he's hearing? What are the implications, the real world implications?
These are pretty day-to-day matters. The appointment was only made over the summer, and you know, talking to environmental advocates on this, they couldn't point to like one big thing that is before the commission, which is also sort of slowed down because of the pandemic.
Right.
And so it's hard to say what exactly the impact has been so far or will be, but there are, you know, the kinds of things like, you know, who has rights under oil leases and coal leases. So, you know, a lot of this is too soon to tell. There is a list that I'm hoping to get from last year which would illuminate people who've been in their jobs longer and may have more time to make an impact. I just think that at this point, it's not clear to me, which doesn't mean that there hasn't been an impact.
Let's tell us about some of the other people that you highlighted in the in your piece. You talk about Gregory Sheehan.
Greg Sheehan was Deputy Director of the Fish and Wildlife Service and functionally the head of it because there was no director, because Ryan Zinke at the time couldn't appoint Sheehan to be the director because he didn't have apparently you have to have a scientific degree to be the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service. So instead he just functionally ran the agency as the deputy and did a lot of things like opening public lands for access to hunting and fishing, which is like not the worst thing, but it's not necessarily protective. And then the thing that environmental groups have been most concerned about is significantly weakening some of the Environmental Species Act rules around critical habitat. So those are things that are going to require attention by the Biden administration if they wish to reverse them. And he left the agency somewhat early, spent a year hanging out in Utah, where he's from, and then popped up again when he was appointed to be head of the Utah State Bureau of Land Management chapter. And in that position, he's actually slowed down some of the leases that were in the works for some of those big public land tracts out there, including Bears Ears National Monument, which was really controversial when they shrank it early in the term. But environmental groups just really don't like this guy, really think that he's going to shepherd through a bunch of the leases that the Trump administration had had put into motion earlier on.
Is there anyone else who really stood out for you as someone who was a sort of a zealot getting in there and looking to, in many ways, undermine what, at least, you know, I think these agencies philosophically should be there. If they're going to err, they should err on the side of protecting the commons that we have tasked them to protect. Are there any zealots that you, or any folks that you perceive who are particularly set on preventing the agency from doing that to the extent that they can?
Yeah. So I wouldn't hesitate to use the word zealot, but like at least folks who, you know, have a different agenda from the ones the Biden folks will bring in when they take office. And the highest profile one of these that came to light was, and this had been reported before, but like not extensively, is a gentleman named Tracy Short, who had been the principal legal director at the Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and had spent his career in government basically prosecuting immigration fraud and defending the government, usually again in cases where they were trying to keep people from entering the country. And so he was appointed to be the chief immigration judge, which is a role that basically runs the courts of immigration judges. There's 30 something of them, and determines the rules that they have to play by and who gets what caseloads. And so obviously, you know, there's been an enormous backlog of cases for years now. And the way that they're dealing with that now is just accelerating the review of those cases in ways that judges have told me, or former judges have told me, makes it really difficult for them to consider the facts of every case. And so, and that's a job, it's a career job. So like they can move him, but it is going to require individual specific attention. It doesn't happen automatically.
How will the Biden administration, how do you move someone in civil service? You just put them in a different job essentially?
Yeah. I mean, the way that it's usually been explained to me is that you can't fire them because you don't like the job that they're doing, but you can say, we are transferring you to the FOIA office or to some place that is like very undesirable. Or like, this is what they did with a whole office of the USDA that does economics research. They said, your jobs are in.
Yes.
It was Wyoming or something.
Yes. Like, what? They moved everybody from Washington. They said, we're going to move the office there. And if you don't want to join us, then you don't have to.
Exactly. And that was widely perceived as a way of just thinning out the office because they didn't like economic analyses on a lot of the, because they were doing a lot of things about climate change and like food stamps. And so that's usually how it would have to be done. Now, the Trump administration has issued an executive order called the Schedule F thing.
Yes.
That allows them to, requires agencies to designate anyone with policy advocating roles be put on this new schedule that kind of makes them this like liminal thing in between a political appointee and a civil service person. And it makes it much easier to transfer them or fire them. And so, you know, that could have been like very damaging if the Trump administration remained in place. They probably don't have enough time to really act on it, although it is happening. But if Biden wanted to keep it around, he could use it to make some initial changes much more quickly than he otherwise would have been able to, although he's under a lot of pressure from unions to just scrap it immediately.
I see what you're saying. So essentially, Schedule F places a significant portion of these otherwise protected employees under a sort of like a quasi status that mm-hmm. Biden could fire them without the civil service protections.
Yeah.
Okay. But unions want to get rid of that because it's a dangerous thing to keep around. This is what I vote for. Keep it for a year, clean up, and then jettison Schedule F. But I know no one's asking my vote on that. All right. Well, thank you so much for this, Lydia. We will put a link to this piece on majority.fm, how dozens of Trump's political appointees will stay in government after Biden takes over. Thanks so much for your time today. Really interesting.
No problem. Thank you.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break. Emma and I will be back with just a little bit more to cover. We're back. Donald Trump was at the Operation Warp Speed press conference the other day. Now, it is becoming clear, Emma, that it's stunning. I don't know really even how to express this. Apparently, what the Trump administration did in ordering vaccinations, and they seem to have really chosen a path and then ignored it despite what's happening. I mean, early on they had, I don't know, maybe there was a half a dozen, maybe a little more, different companies working on vaccinations, right? And on the outset, you don't necessarily know who is going to have an inside track, who is going to be more successful. So they basically said, we're going to place one bet on each. And that bet's going to be 100 million doses. And then as it seemed to move forward, as it became clear that Pfizer and Moderna were sort of having more success in their testing or had developed quicker for whatever reason, they went to the Trump administration and said, look, you know, at least Pfizer, you should buy more. And the Trump administration, no, we're not interested. Apparently, they did. They only bought 100 million doses from Pfizer and Moderna. Apparently, they purchased 300 million doses. This is from Politico, from AstraZeneca. For whatever reason, it's unclear. Now, AstraZeneca... Yeah. We're unclear as to why they do, but the outlook for the AstraZeneca vaccine at this point is mixed. Yeah. They are not using the mRNA technology. They're trying to address it in a different way, maybe a more traditional way, and they're not having as much success with it. There is another one out there, Johnson & Johnson, which supposedly would only take one shot and makes it easier to manufacture in some ways, but we still don't know. We don't have as much clarity on that. But
the Moderna and the Pfizer are the ones that seem to be the most successful being implemented in the UK right now, the Pfizer one. And to use your betting analogy, they were playing with house money. I mean, this is the time to spend government money. And yet they chose to only bet $20 on each of these vaccines, as opposed to you have about $100,000 in your pocket and none of it's yours. So go for it.
It's completely bizarre. Roughly, according to Politico, roughly 650 million of the 1.3 billion doses Pfizer says it can make in 2021 are already spoken for. Now, I mean, look, it's pretty simple math. If they say they can do $1.3 billion doses over the course of a year, and the first 650 million are spoken for, That means that they're not going to be able to get to the 650 million and one dose until June, right? I mean,
right.
If it takes you 12 months to produce 1.3 billion doses, you're not going to get to the doses that they have available now until June. And so the U.S. government today could say, okay, we're in. And Pfizer apparently would be like, well, yeah, okay, we'll get it to you. We'll start shipping in June. We got 100 million doses before then in the first tranche, essentially.
Enough for 50 million people, which enough is likely, ostensibly going to higher risk people, frontline workers, et cetera. Although I'm sure the wealthy will wiggle their way into getting some of the earlier doses.
Moderna says it can make anywhere from 500 million to a billion doses next year, which is a pretty wide flex there. But it's already promised 380 million shots to various countries. And they said just delivering those doses to governments have already ordered could take 6 months or more. So again, for the Moderna shot, and again, the U.S. government ordered 100 million. That's 50 million people. We may not see another dose from them until June in this country.
Because the Trump administration decided to not, you know, bet enough money on either of these front runners here for whatever reason. It's not like this was coming out of Trump's individual pockets where I can understand why that guy might be cheap because he's in a lot of debt. No, this was the number one function of government is to invest in these vaccines. And they chose to be cheap here for no reason, seemingly except to, I don't know, favor AstraZeneca or adhere to conservative ideology and be a part of the cult of conservative economic policy. I don't understand.
Well, I mean, that's the point. We don't know what the answer is. And so an opposition party that was determined to highlight the mistakes that this Republican administration has made, regardless of the fact that they're not going to be here, would be calling for hearings right now to find out exactly why they chose AstraZeneca to bet on, why when the Pfizer people came and said, look, you should buy another 400 billion doses here. Because listen, we're looking at a situation right now in terms of what we know for proven vaccinations. We're looking at a situation now where we only can cover 100 million people in this country at best until June. And then in June, theoretically, we're still having to roll out both production and the shots. I mean, this is...
Which we don't have money for, which because Congress has been unable to act, there's no funding for vaccine distribution.
There is no support for municipal or state to actually distribute this vaccination in terms of money. I mean, this is a huge, huge mess up. And there is only so much that the Democrats can do to rectify this. But again, this is one of those perfect situations where it's like, make them pay a political price for their total incompetence. This is not an ideological thing here.
Just
this is basically saying
the airwaves. Like,
this is,
make your case.
And the only way you do that is you call hearings. You call hearings. It's not enough to go on the 6 p.m. show on a cable news network and say, you know, from the rotunda and say, I think this is a bad idea. You need to start to investigate why this is for the American public. Really just shocking.
There's a reason that Pelosi put the progressives like Ocasio-Cortez on the oversight committee and stuff like that instead of, you know, more powerful ones. She wanted their progressive aggression on oversight with the Trump administration. So use that to your political advantage.
Yep.
Use their bully pulpit in the way that you tried to maneuver things.
In the second half of the program, we're going to highlight a tweet thread by Katie Porter. And, you know, the other day we were talking about, we were displaying Katie Porter's messaging about needing stimulus versus Nancy Pelosi's message, which is like, well, we don't have to worry about it as much now because Joe Biden's here. Again, Katie Porter has this tweet thread where she is out there calling out Mitch McConnell and making it very, very clear who is inhibiting us going forward and bringing the desperate needed help that folks have. In
well,
the
she
wake
must
of,
be in a safe blue district, right, Sam? She must just be one of those socialists in the squad who are in these city safe districts. Oh, wait, she's actually in a district that tilts red and has won re-election.
Right. And the thing is, like, she is putting on a clinic as to how you message these things. But of course, she is a freshman House member. And it's not going to get necessarily the same play in mainstream media as it would if we had this from the Democratic leadership. I mean, this is, you know, and before we get any pushback on this, before you send me any emails, the bottom line is I understand it is the Republicans who are standing in the way of this. But I understand that because I do this professionally and I read every day and I read more than I would ever wish upon anybody about this stuff. The point is the opposition party needs to be out there and making it clear to as many people as possible. And the way that you do that is you hold hearings. The way that you do that is you force votes that they don't want to take in these instances. And the forcing votes opportunity that passed, you know, since the election. But there is no reason why there can't be hearings today. No reasons whatsoever. And also in the next half of the program, we're going to talk about Richie Neal, the congressman from Western Massachusetts, who part of the leadership, chairing the Ways and Means Committee, I think it is. And he is standing in the way of a bipartisan legislation that is a fix for surprise medical billing. It is stunning. And this is part of the reason why we had
donations have anything to do with that, Sam.
It's yeah, exactly. This is part of the reason why we were pushing so hard in his primary election, because regardless of what you thought of the other candidate, although I thought he was actually quite good, Morse, Richie Neal is standing in the way of help for people. And working, apparently, it only seems like, for insurance companies and big corporations. But we will talk more about that in the future. If you missed any part of this show, check it out on Peacock tonight. You can check it out on the Choice Channel, 5 p.m., 10 p.m., and later through the night. We will see you tomorrow. And if you're sticking around, we will see you right this second.
Yeah.
Right this moment, you're seeing me.
You're seeing me too in this and you're seeing Emma as second. Well, although there's a delay, they're maybe seeing us 10 seconds later.
Well, it doesn't matter because they're still seeing us, even if we're traveling through the time space continuum, they're still seeing us,
which we are see Jamie. Always.
And in a moment you'll see Jamie. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show and you get extra content every day. Check it out. jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority. Get 10% off. Try the Majority Report blend. What else? amquickie.com. Check that out. And we have merch. shop.majorityreportradio.com. Now back from her hopefully temporary illness. Jamie, what happened to you on Monday?
It's not a very funny story. I was just up late with anxiety and I took a tiny bit of Xanax and then I woke up and I was like, I should not be on TV right now.
Stay away from those benzos. That stuff, not good. Not healthy.
No, I mean, it might have given me a little window into what it's like to be near a Tandon, though. I feel like I understand her better now.
That's funny, sorry.
Well, I've never heard of being up all night with anxiety. That's a completely foreign concept to me. In the meantime, what's happening on the Antifada?
Well, this week on the Antifada, Sean and I, we did a vibes ep because we read a whole book last week. Can't do that every week. talked about some news. I'm not selling this very well. We talked about the COVID vaccine and the politics around that. Uber got owned. They basically gave up on their bet on self-driving cars becoming a reality anytime soon. Real estate tycoons have recorded record profits during the pandemic. Amazon workers are organizing in Alabama and much, much more. Also, later today, we are in soft launch mode for our Twitch channel right now, but I trust you guys. I trust everyone watching this to watch it and be nice. So at 7 p.m., Sean and I are going to be doing a Twitch stream from the Antifada's Twitch channel with Tony Boswell from Minion Death Cult, a very funny podcast.
Oh,
Twitch
is where it's at.
Yeah, twitch.tv/theantifada.
Folks, don't forget today on 3 p.m., the Noma Key Show. You can find the Noma Key Show at youtube.com/the Noma Key Show. On today, I think Representative Chris Robb, but I know for a fact Shahid Buttar will be on. I imagine he has some criticism of the way that Democratic leadership has been handling this as well. You know, so frustrating. But check it out. And tomorrow on the Noma Key Show, Marianne Williamson is on. So Shahid Buttar. I've got to mispronounce his name. Otherwise, people...
It's Shahid, It's Shahid.
Yeah, Shahid. People, if I don't mispronounce their name now they get offended if I don't mispronounce their name.
It's suspicious.
People, Sam calls me Ema all the time.
People
just
feel
can't get it right.
People feel like I'm dissing them if I pronounce their name correctly, which is not true. It's just but I understand the sensitivity that people have to that.
It's like your party trick.
Exactly.
Or Mott, it's like, now do me.
Mott.
Yeah, a couple things to plug. Last night on TMBS, there was a panel with the economists Mark Blythe and Richard Wolff, and joined by David Griscom and Ben Burgess. So pretty heavy hitter panel last night. Check that out. Also on Thursday, David and I will be streaming from the Left Reckoning YouTube channel. And on Friday, right after this show, I'm going to steal the raid. I will be listening to Marx's Critique of the Goth program for a patron-only episode that will be recorded over the weekend. So a lot of stuff coming up for Left Reckoning as well. So check that stuff
out. Matt Letch, very, very busy.
I do get that a lot, actually.
I bet. Yeah, all right, folks.
I bet you do.
Quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will take your IMs and see you in the fun half.
RM for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, back, back. Back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a man.
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danner?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Hell of the bank. Hell of the bank. Hell of the bank. Hell of the bank.
you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. African. The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
You see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on.
What? Come on.
What?
Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, 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 pussy.